Sometimes those chants can sound pretty depressing. We're subject to aging, illness, and death, and separation. The world is swept away. It does not endure. But they're a simple statement of fact. And sometimes the statement of fact is actually consoling. When we're suffering from aging, illness, death, or separation, it's good to be reminded that we're not the only ones. This is a fact of life for everyone. And it's good to face it squarely. The Buddha was like a doctor. You go to see the doctor, and the doctor asks, "Where does it hurt?" You're not accusing the doctor of being pessimistic. The doctor is doing his job, recognizing that there is hurt, but there's also the possibility of curing it. That's why the doctor's there. If there are certain diseases that the doctor is afraid to talk about, it means the doctor doesn't have the cure. But the Buddha talks openly and freely about aging, illness, death, separation, all the various forms of stress and suffering, because he has a cure. That's a self-administered cure. We learn from him, we learn from his example, we learn from the example of all the noble disciples. The Buddha's time on up into the present. And their example alerts us that the cure works. And we don't have any proof until we've tried the cure ourselves. But at least seeing that there are examples out there, people who claim that they have gotten beyond all forms of suffering and stress, that alerts us to the possibility that human life can be devoted, can be aimed in that direction, and actually get results. There's a story when the Buddha was still a prince and thinking about going out into the forest wilderness. His father tried to do everything he could to discourage him. In one version of the story, the father gets a devious friend to come and speak to the young prince to say, "Well, other people have tried in the past and it hasn't worked. Content yourself with the ordinary everyday pleasures. That's the best a human life has to offer." Fortunately, the young prince was not swayed. Went out and actually found the path to the end of suffering, but also found it was something that had to be done within the mind. Because we suffer from our lack of skill in how we handle sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations, all the thoughts of the mind. And no one else can make us skillful. They can show us by example that the skill can be mastered, and they can give us pointers. But we have to do the work ourselves. We have to learn how to look inside to see what strengths we have and learn how to utilize them. Realizing that one of our problems is delusion. This is why we need the teachings from the outside, from someone else, to alert us to what might go wrong. But we also need to be self-correcting. That chant just now of the world being swept away. The practice is like building a house on sand. The sands shift. And so for the house to be really stable, it has to have some sort of self-correcting mechanism inside, kind of like a gyroscope in the house. This image is going to start falling apart pretty soon. But you get the basic idea. You can't depend on the world outside for your stability or your balance or any real solidity in life. The as well, the mind has to learn how to be self-correcting. That's why evaluation is an important part of the meditation. We're working with the breath. It's not just a matter of in, out, in, out, in, out. It's learning how to ask yourself, what kind of breathing can the mind stay with? What kind of breathing feels good for the body? What kind of breathing feels good for the mind? What kind of breathing is clear enough so we can focus on it, but soothing enough so that it's actually calming, allows the mind to settle down? Then once the breath feels good, what do you do with that good feeling? And John Lee suggests spreading it around the body. You read his different Dharma talks and his different writings, and you find that he has lots of different ways of suggesting how you do this. So you try his ways, and if they don't work, you start thinking up your own. As John Fuang used to say, the two things you need as a meditator are one, to be observant, and two, to be ingenious. Those are the two faculties you've got to use. Watching what's going on, if something doesn't seem to be working out right, try to figure out what might work, then test it, and then evaluate that. Observe the results. This way the mind becomes self-correcting. And learns to explore possibilities that it might not have thought of before. This is the Buddha said, there's the discernment that comes from listening, and there's the discernment that comes from thinking things through. But the discernment that really works in making a difference for the mind, allowing it to gain release from its suffering, is the discernment that comes from developing qualities in the mind. And so the understanding you're going to gain as you work at the meditation is going to show you new possibilities that even the writings don't suggest. So it's especially important as we meditate, as we learn how to train this faculty of evaluation, to notice when things are in balance and when they're getting out of balance, and what you might do to get them back in. Because after all, the mind is its own teacher. You learn from external teachers, but external teachers can't keep looking at your mind all the time, even if they could read minds. It's asking too much of them to be reading your mind 24/7. You've got to learn how to read your own mind 24/7. And to get an idea of the different ways it might go out of balance. There's one passage where the Buddha compares the training of the mind to the work of a goldsmith. So the goldsmith has to time and again blow on the gold that he's put in the smelter. He has to sprinkle water on it time and again, and he has to evaluate it. Watch it carefully, examine it. And it's a combination of these three things that gets the gold properly melted, properly purified, malleable, so he can make what he wants out of the gold. If you did it just any one thing, just sprinkled water on it, the gold would never get melted. It would cool off too fast. If you just blew on it, the gold would burn up too fast. If you just looked at it, nothing would happen. So it's a balance of those three faculties, those three activities. The same way when you're meditating. There are three themes you have to keep in mind. One is the theme of concentration, which would be any of the establishings of mindfulness, the body in and of itself, feelings in and of themselves, mind, mental qualities in and of themselves. For instance, right now, when we're with the breath, you've got the body in the actual sensation of the breath, and then the feelings of pleasure and pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that come from the way you deal with the breath. Then the various mind states that are either with the breath or wandering away. the questions you might want to ask about how your mind is going. We can observe that right here, too. And then there are the different mental qualities. Are you tied up in the hindrances, or are you actually developing the factors for awakening? And these factors for awakening, are they coming in a balanced way? All these things are the themes of concentration. And we stay focused on these things. Make them your frame of reference. And just staying with the breath, if you could just do that, would not be enough. You need two other themes to think about. One is what the Buddha calls the theme of uplifting. In other words, energizing the mind. So that if it sees any unskillful qualities in the mind, it doesn't just sit there and watch them. It actually tries to figure out how to abandon them. If it sees anything lacking, how do you give rise to the skillful qualities that you need? You have to put effort and energy into this. And then the third theme is equanimity. Which means being able to watch what's actually happening. Watch your actions, watch the results. And learn how to be a reliable observer. Of what's actually happening. Now, any of these qualities, the Buddha said, if you do it just on its own, it doesn't get you anywhere. If you just stay with the concentration, it says you're going to fall into laziness. If you just stay with trying to energize yourself, energizing yourself, you get restless, worked up. If you just stay with equanimity, you never really get into the proper concentration that would count as right concentration. Things just arise and pass away, and they just arise and pass away, and that's it. Nothing gets developed. Nothing gets abandoned. You see things arise and pass away. You say, well, they do it on their own. I don't have to do anything. But they're going to keep on arising and passing away, and that doesn't get you past suffering. So you've got to learn how to bring all these three qualities together, that you do want to stay concentrated and focused on your basic frame of reference. You want to energize yourself to do whatever activity is needed to get more and more skillful. And ferreting out unskillful states of mind and developing skillful ones. Learning how to abandon whatever needs to be abandoned and develop whatever needs to be developed. And the equanimity that helps prevent the mind from getting restless, worked up about this. You've got to bring these into balance. Otherwise, the mind won't be able to find the refuge that it needs. Because this is what it all comes down to, is we're trying to find a safe place for the mind, a safe place to protect what's valuable in the mind, and to stay away from danger. Aging, illness, and death are coming. Separation has happened and is going to keep on happening. The world is constantly swept away. It doesn't endure. There's nobody in charge. Nothing that really belongs to it. And if we're not careful, we just keep coming back and back and back to these unstable, unreliable things through the force of craving. So we've got to learn how to see through the allure of that craving, to see why we get involved with it, why we keep pushing, pushing, pushing for things that are going to keep on disappointing, disappointing, disappointing. This is why the mind has to learn how to observe itself. We talk about the committee of the mind. This is one area where the committee can actually be useful. You have different members. You have the equanimity member. You've got the concentration member. You've got the uplifted energy member. And you want them to work together. to be able to observe one another, to see where things are lacking, or see where things are too much. We can't depend on a Johnny one-note kind of meditation where it's just equanimity or just stillness or just noting or just anything. It's a combination of factors. Otherwise, it's like trying to build a house with nothing but a hammer, or to make a cake with nothing but flour. We don't get anywhere because a lot of the ingredients and a lot of the tools are missing. So remember, you've got to be your own teacher, you've got to be your own evaluator of what's going on. And you want to make sure the mind doesn't fall off into any one extreme, or extreme equanimity, or extreme concentration, or extreme effort. These three qualities have to learn how to work together. For us to find the release and the refuge that we want and need.